Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. The date is Saturday, April 20th, and my name is Janice Bellucci. I'm a civil rights attorney, and I'm also executive director of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. So we're so happy to see you today. We hope that you'll learn many important things today. We're here to share information with you, and we're also here to listen. So if you have a question, if you have a comment that you would like to make, please put your hand up at any time, your virtual hand. Though if you can't figure that out, you can put your hand up like this too, old-fashioned way, and we'll call on you. It may take a minute to get to you because we might want to follow up a comment that we're in the middle of or something we're in the middle of discussing some particular topic. So we do this on a monthly basis, we being the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. I have been here every single month for years, and Jeff Stein has joined me in the last 6 or so months, and I'm so happy to have him joining this meeting because I'm a civil attorney, and Jeff is a criminal defense attorney. So many times you all have questions that might have a criminal nature, and I can't really answer them, but Jeff can. So Jeff, perhaps you could say a few words about yourself today.
Glad to. Good morning, everyone. So I started doing the work in law school back in the Nixon-era administration, and I've been practicing criminal defense from the first day I got licensed in 1975 till the present. I live in San Luis Obispo, but I've taken cases around the state because the issues are common for all counties, different DA personalities, different judge personalities, but the issues are all the same. It's been an evolving and developing process. I've done legislative work, which Axol is certainly a main carrier on at this point on our issues. And we've had, as the enactment in 2017 of SB 384 indicates, dramatic positive transformations of the opportunity to terminate people off the registry. And those are things that I'm primarily involved in pursuing and have a fair amount of insight into it. I'm glad to share that information and help folks along the way.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jeff. And I'm in awe of Jeff and all the work that he does. I'm pretty sure, Jeff, we met at least 10 years ago when I also lived near San Luis Obispo, and our paths crossed at that point in time with the work that Jeff was doing and I was doing. And it's been a real blessing to have you join the board, Jeff, about a year ago. So, and the fact that you're now joining me on these Saturday meetings is even a greater blessing. So thank you so much.
It's mutual. It's
Thank you.
longer than 10 years, too, I hate
Okay.
to say.
Someday I really should go back and count. Okay, so welcome. I know that there's more people who've joined us in the last few minutes. Let me go ahead and reintroduce this meeting. It's on Saturday, April 20th, and the meeting is of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. My name is Janice Bellucci. I'm executive director of the Alliance, and I'm also a civil rights attorney. So I'm a civil attorney, and Jeff was a criminal attorney. So as always, we have topics to discuss today. If there's a specific topic that you would like Jeff or I to discuss, would you go ahead and add that in the chat room, and we'll do our best to get to that topic. We have a lot of exciting and positive news to share today. I almost feel like a kid on Christmas because there's so much good news to share. It's not always this way, so when it is this way, it certainly brings a smile to my face. So having said that, there's two topics we discuss every month, and we discuss them every month for a reason, and that's because they keep popping up again. One of them is compliance checks, and the other one is scams. So, Jeff, which one would you like to lead the discussion on? And then I'll start the other one.
I think scams are probably a good place to start. So, for those of you who have been on the receiving end, this is not news. It may be a little PTSD flashback, and it may be something that you've developed a coping strategy for. For the folks who've not been visited by this particular phenomena, it comes like some law enforcement techniques as a means to try and take you out of your comfort zone. The phenomena is because everyone, or at least many people, most people are listed on the internet, they're vulnerable to being identified not just by the general run-of-the-mill trolls, but by thieves. And the thieves have developed coping strategies to try and make you feel uncomfortable and feel coercively vulnerable to complying with requests that seem at least superficially reasonable or at least understandable. And the threats have as their echo that you've somehow missed some deadline, failed to accomplish some required task, and the threat explicitly says there's a warrant out for your arrest that you have to immediately cope with, or else you're going to be grabbed and put in custody. And they're nice enough to say that they have a coping strategy, which is that they'll meet you or afford an access line or an email or a number where you can send particularly common gift card verification numbers to pay off the warrant so you don't have to go into custody. These are classic scam artists aiming at getting you out of your comfort zone and aiming to create anxiety and the kind of urgency that propels people to act before they can think through what the requests are. I've had many clients call either just before, during, or just after this process. Some have paid money to try and buy off the threat. Most have been able to be guided away from that risk. But you should anticipate you're going to get calls from people who seem absolutely authentic from the police department or the sheriff's department. And you should recognize that when they want to arrest people in real police departments, they don't call to give you notice. They come with overwhelming power and force, and they don't take money off credit cards. So if you get those calls, Janice's historic advice, which I agree to entirely, is just hang up and don't stay online, don't talk, and recognize that those are all fraud.
Great. And folks, if indeed you give money to these scammers, you will not get it back. Okay. A lot of times, in my understanding, is they tell you, as Jeff was just saying, give the codes off of gift cards, and then the next thing, or do something that has to do with purchasing cryptocurrency. So as good as Jeff and I are as attorneys, and we're very good, the fact is we'll never be able to get your money back, and no one will either. So, and I understand too, one of the reasons they sound so credible is they identify themselves as Sergeant so-and-so or Detective blah, 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 right? It's fictional. So I don't know what they watch, NCIS or some of those other shows where they pick up names of detectives and police sergeants, but it's all a lie. And again, if you get the money, you will never see it again. Oh, and in addition to that, you're not going to be helped in any way. So the other thing we talk about, other topic every month is the compliance checks. And so I'm particularly sensitive about these compliance checks because I do get calls from time to time, actually on a fairly regular basis, about people sharing with me their experiences of a compliance check. What a compliance check is supposed to be is that somebody comes to your residence and they ask you, is your name so-and-so? Yes. Is this your current address? Yes. And that's a compliance check. Okay. Nothing else. That's where it starts and that's where it ends, if it's indeed a compliance check. Now, if you're on parole or if you're on probation, in other words, you're on quote on paper, then if they're there, they can't come into your home and they can search your home. But most of the people, fortunately, are not on parole and they're not on probation. If you fit into that category, you do not have to even answer the door. Okay. If they come and knock on your door, and I understand sometimes it's pretty frightening because there are multiple police officials outside your door and dressed in SWAT clothing, you can't ignore them. Okay. If you want to. Now, maybe you don't want to, again, because they look like a pretty menacing presence outside your front door, and maybe you don't want your neighbors to see these people in uniform and who are armed at your residence. So if you decide to speak to them, then this is what my advice is. Walk outside your front door and close the front door behind you. Now, why am I making this suggestion? It has to do with the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which, by the way, you are protected by, even though you're required to register. Okay, so the thing is, when law enforcement comes to your home, unless they have a warrant or a few other very minor exceptions, they can't search your house. Okay, and again, I'm talking about people who are not on parole and not on probation. But the problem is, if you let them in the house and they just just look around as the curious people that they are, they might find something that they consider illegal. So in the good old days, I'm being sarcastic, some people who rolled their own tobacco cigarettes might have papers laying around for rolling those cigarettes, and the police would say, that's drug paraphernalia. And the next thing you know, they're basically searching your entire house for drugs. So, and there's a lot of other things. This was a real case situation with one of my clients where he had a Bible, and the Bible had within it paintings, drawings of children. And he was not supposed to have, he's not supposed to have photos of children. The next thing you know, he was being hauled in for having child pornography. So, this is how ridiculous things can be. And that's why we're suggesting that you don't let them in your house. So it's up to you what you actually do about a compliance check. Again, in the good old days, I can't remember what TV show it was. They used to say, you just have to give them your name, rank, and serial number. Well, you need to give them your name and your address, and that's all. And then if they want something more, you can say, gosh, gee whiz, my attorney said, right? My attorney said not to answer any more questions. Thank you for your time, and politely reenter your residence. So again, it's up to you how much you want to tell them, but I've heard some pretty horrible stories about people being asked in their driveway all about their offense and other things. And that is not a compliance check. You want to add to that, Jeff?
No, I think that's good advice. The police are in the excavation business. That's their purpose. Your purpose is not to be dug into.
That's a good way to put it. All right. Okay, so let's go on. So these are some of the topics we're planning to talk about today. And again, if there's some other topic you'd like us to talk about, then you can add either put your hand up and make the request that way, or you can put it in the chat room, which I don't know about you, Jeff, but I'm trying to check the chat room as we're going. So if I'm not staring into the camera time to time, that's why. So anyway, we're talking about travel, both domestic and overseas. We're talking about Halloween sign requirements in three states now. So we have filed lawsuits in Missouri and Arkansas, and I'll give you update on those cases. But also we now have a third state, which is Texas. Then we're going to talk about registrants on parole here in California and the in treatment. And we have a wonderful, wonderful case here that's near resolution that's going to make a huge difference to at least 7,000 people in California who are both on the registry and on parole. And then we're going to talk about another positive case that has already been settled, and that is people who were convicted of an attempted offense. So in California, what was happening under the tiered registry law is the Department of Justice was assigning people convicted of an attempted offense to the same tier as if they had actually completed the offense. And so we took that them to court, and we won in court. So we've got a DeSorna case that's pending with the Pacific Legal Foundation. We're planning to talk about that as well briefly. So folks, if you have anything else that you would like us to talk about, please put it in the chat room or put your hand up. When we're talking about a specific topic, though, if you could keep your questions and your comments to that topic, we'd really appreciate it. And then again, if you want something else in the future, you can let us know here in the chat room. Okay, and there's 8 new messages, oh dear. All right. Marty, I like your comment there on Dragnet. You have the right to remain silent. I remember that. So when you're not on paper, remember those very special words. life is so interesting, isn't it? Okay, Panther, you got your hand up. Would you like to ask a question or make a comment? Somebody who's identified as Panther, you've got your hand up?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. How can we help you?
Hi. I was asked a question about Section 8, and got in Section 8.
You did?
Due to being a tier 1.
That's fabulous. Congratulations. Well, Panther, why don't we, if you don't mind, let me give a little bit of background to this. And again, I congratulate you on that success, because there's a federal regulation that basically says if you're on a registry for lifetime, you're not eligible to live in Section 8 housing, and you're certainly not eligible to obtain Section 8 housing. So with it having a tiered registry in California is helping many people now become eligible for Section 8 housing because they've been assigned to Tier 1 or Tier 2. And so did I hear you correctly, Panther, that you've been assigned to Tier 1?
Yes.
Okay. How was that experience for you? Because I know initially HUD wasn't paying attention. That's the federal agency. But a lot of times you're dealing with state or local governments as well. And so I know I wrote a few memos basically explaining that the law had changed in California. Did you have any trouble with that?
When I first got the voucher, I was like, they first denied me because they were saying that it was within 5 years. Then I explained to them that, you know, it's been like over 5 years since my conviction. I was convicted in 2018. I explained to them it was over 5 years because mine was January and I petitioned like somewhere in September or August of 2023.
Okay. So Panther, I want to make sure I'm understanding correctly and everybody else. Are you no longer required to register?
No, not yet.
Okay. But you are a Tier 1, and so you will be eligible to petition for removal.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Well, Panther, I'm really happy that you shared that good news with us. And anybody else who's listening to this, either today when we're live or it is being recorded in the future, it's true. If in fact you're assigned to Tier 1 or you're assigned to Tier 2, you are now eligible for Section 8 housing, okay? And if you have any trouble, if you run into any problems with a government official, please let me know. I have a handy-dandy legal memorandum that I've written and that I've shared with many people. And I make it specific to you. It's not just a generic legal memo, but it's worked in the past. And so for Panther, he was able to make it work well. So that is excellent news. Okay. So I don't see any other question or hands up rather. And I see some questions here. So here we go. We're going to talk about travel and somebody's asked a question about cruises. All right. Okay. So when we're traveling domestically, okay, if you're currently required to register and you want to travel domestically, Jeff and I are here to tell you to be very careful. And the reason that we're telling you to be very careful, or strongly recommending that you be very careful, is that you could unintentionally end up on another state's registry, okay? And the general advice is to stay off of registries as much as possible. So once you get off the registry in the state where you were convicted, for example, here in California, that doesn't mean that you don't, unfortunately, that doesn't mean it's like get out of jail free car in the game of Monopoly. Instead, you still have to be mindful of what the registration requirements are. And there is no clear answer out here, folks. I wish that there were. There just isn't. So the reason I'm saying that is that in some states, if you've ever been convicted of a sex offense, ever in your whole life, you have to register there, okay? Even if you're not currently required to register in the state of conviction. There are other states that say exactly the opposite, and then there are states in between. And not only that, just to make things a little more confusing, is sometimes it depends the offense for which you were convicted. And so, I've done this for some people in the past. I have to admit, I don't enjoy doing it because it's a deep dive into not only California laws, if you were convicted in California, but also the laws in the other states. So one way I say this informally and almost flippantly is there's an easy or inexpensive way to do this, to deal with this, and then there's an inexpensive way to deal with this, okay? So here goes my rule of thumb. What I mean by easy and inexpensive is if you proceed as if you're still currently required to register, then you'll have a lot less risk than if you proceed in a different way, okay? So for example, there are states out there, and I'm always picking on Florida, so I'm going to continue to pick on Florida. And by the way, Florida and Nevada are in the same categories here, which is if you visit those states for more than 48 hours, you're required to register in that state. Okay. What happens if you don't register? Maybe nothing. On the other hand, if you're detected in the state of Florida or in the state of Nevada, guess what could happen? You could end up in jail. You could end up getting convicted of a felony and spending some time in custody. It's up to you. You know, Jeff and I are not the ones we're going to end up in custody. You are the ones who are going going to end up in custody if you take a risk and it doesn't bear fruit. So let's talk about something positive. Hawaii. You can visit, even if you're required to register, you can go visit Hawaii for up to 10 days at a time without registering. You can visit Hawaii up to 30 days a calendar year without being required to register. Okay. If you want to visit Hawaii for a longer period of time, then you might have to register. So it's up to you, again, on the spectrum of low risk. I think there's never no risk, but from low risk to high risk, how much risk are you willing to take and willing to assume to travel from one state to another? And I will tell you, from time to time, people contact me and say, oh gosh, gee whiz, I want to travel across the country in a recreational vehicle. And, I want to spend as much time as I want to spend in each state. You can do that regardless of whether or not you're required to register in your state of conviction, but doing so could be fraught with danger. And I don't recommend it. Jeff, what would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I think the hardest thing to really come to terms with is the success that SB 384 creates for California residents who are terminated from their duty to register isn't termination from the duty to register anywhere except California. The reason for that is that the California law is that despite the fact that the underlying conviction remains validly on the record, California's made a policy decision that registration is not appropriate to continue. That policy decision is a state-by-state determination. That's why there's 50 different formulas in the 50 different states. And so you have to just view your success in California as an opportunity in regard to living here. But for every state you want to go to, you have to do an individual evaluation, and the two ways are to do it exploring state law where you want to go, or to contact a lawyer in the state where you want to go to be able to get more nuanced kind of information.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. And folks, put an exclamation point after that if you're planning to move from one state to another state. Okay, I would not recommend moving to another state without knowing what the registration requirements are, regardless of whether or not you're currently required to register in your state of conviction. So people are getting some real nasty surprises. And I know one man in particular, I'm trying to remember I think the state was Nevada. And so I was able to get him off the registry in California. He had some property in Nevada and he wanted to go move there. Well, I referred him to Nevada attorney. As it turned out, was able to figure out how to do it with her help. But it was one of those things, if he had just blundered into it kind of blindly and not looked into what he was required to do, he could have ended up back custody. And folks, we're saying these things to help you. I mean, we understand that there's a minefield out there, right? There's so many different laws and regulations and stuff. And, I know some people just throw their hands up and say, well, I'm not going to go anywhere and do anything. Please, I hope you don't take that approach, but please just be careful. Jeff is available as a resource. I'm available as a resource. There's information on the Axel website. So if you look at the home page and there's a link called Legal, if you click on that, then there's a drop-down menu. One piece of advice, though, or one thing you need to know is that information is not necessarily current. The only reason we keep it there is because it gives you the statute numbers and everything so you can look up the state laws yourself. Okay. So say, I want to go visit Montana, and I can't tell you off the top of my head what the Montana requirements are, but I could go to that chart. I could get the citation to the Montana law that's relevant and go right there and help guide you through it. Many people can do it themselves and stuff, but again, we just want you to be careful. So,
Along that line, one other thought, and this is for a smaller subset of people, that is if you're currently living in another state and want to think about moving to California, California does evaluate and can eliminate your duty to register here based either on your conviction in another state or based on if you had been convicted in California, moved out and are wanting to move back. That's an individualized case-by-case evaluation, but it can result in a successful termination for California residents. And so if that's an applicable circumstance, it's worth exploring and something to talk about.
That's a really good point, Jeff. Thank you for mentioning it. Okay, so we've talked about domestic travel. Let's talk about overseas travel. And somebody asked a question about a cruise line. I have to admit, when I see cruises, I think of overseas travel, but it's possible to take a domestic cruise. The answer to the question about whether or not you can go on a cruise, let's take it two ways. One, you're still currently required to register, or number two, you're a former registrant. The fact is, in both cases, it's really up to the cruise line, okay? With the cruise lines are private businesses. They're not government, so they don't have to do business with you. Remember the old signs in the door or the windows of restaurants, no shoes, no shirt, you can't come in here as a customer. So the cruise lines are that way as well. It really is in your best interest to check in with a cruise line before you sign up for a cruise, certainly before you pay them money, to find out what their policy is, because they can tell you very abruptly and close to the time of your departure whether or not they're going to actually let you on board the ship. And many years ago, I was contacted by somebody who had purchased passage on a Royal Caribbean cruise. And in that his situation, they only told him like 10 days before he and his wife were to depart that they weren't going to let him on board the ship. Now, they also told him they weren't going to give him his money back and all kinds of other nonsense, in which case I wrote a letter to the cruise line and I was able to get him his refund. I couldn't get him on the cruise ship at all because that is a decision by a private company about whether or not to allow you on board. And I'm not defending them at all, but I just wanted to explain a bit where some cruise ships got sued significantly because passengers on their ship were sexually assaulted. And that's kind of where this is coming from. I think that it's like a pendulum swinging. I think after a while, there's going to be less concern about this, but right now, and it's starting to subside because it's not as bad as it was at one point in time. But again, please be very careful about cruise lines. Now, some cruise ships or cruise lines, I understand, will let you on the ship, but then when you get to a port, maybe they won't let you off the ship or you try to get off the ship and you're not allowed to get off the ship. Mexico is one of those countries. Mexico does not denies entry to people who are currently required to register, I'm sorry to say. And I say that because I'm from California. It's so easy to get to Mexico, right, from California. But you just need to be really careful before you pay money to do something like that. So that's cruise lines. Then in addition to that, the government, so that's private. What can the private sector do? Then we can talk about what can the government sector do. Well, there's a federal law out there called the International Megan's Law, and I hope you all know about it by now. Somebody's being congratulated for getting off the registry. That is wonderful news. If you're going to travel overseas and you're a covered sex offender, that's the term under the law, International Megan's Law. I don't like to use the term sex offender at all, but I do when I'm quoting the law. So under the International Megan's Law, you are a covered sex offender if both of the following apply. Your offense involved a minor, which means by the federal definition, under 18, so it could be 17, 16 and younger, all right, and you're currently required to register in any state. This is the reason why Jeff and I keep trying to advise you not to register in another state, okay? If you're required to register in one state, that's bad enough, but if you're registering in multiple states, then your life gets much more complicated, especially if you want to travel overseas. So again, number one, your victim, alleged victim anyway, was under the age of 18, and number two, you're currently required to register in any state. Even the states like Florida and New York that refuse to take you off their registry, right? Even people who don't live there anymore in Florida, even people who are dead, they're not taking you off the registry, but it's not going to affect your international travel if you're dead, right? But still, it's ridiculous. So if those two things apply, then guess what? You have to give 21-day notice to the office where you register, a minimum of 21-day notice before before you leave overseas, and you have to give them very specific information about your overseas travel. For example, what flight are you taking to get there? And I mean, they want the date, time, and place. They want the flight number, right? Where are you going to stay when you're overseas? Now, you don't have to give them, your daily itinerary. You can just say, I'm flying into Rome, Italy on this date at this time. Here's my flight number, and I'm going to stay at the, you know, the, do they have whatever hotels, you know, an airport hotel. That's all you have to tell them, okay? And then I'm coming back on this day on this flight. What you do in between, well, there can be some flexibility there. So you have to do that. The other thing is, if you are, quote, a covered sex offender, then the federal government can basically revoke your passport anytime they feel like it. And that can be really painful, and I'll share a story in a minute. And the other thing is, if you apply for a new passport, then they're supposed to add a unique identifier to your passport. And the language of the unique identifier is, and I'm paraphrasing, says this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. And some people think that's benign language. I don't think that's benign language, because it doesn't say how long ago you were convicted. It doesn't say what the age of your victim was. And it doesn't even say whether or not this involved physical contact. So literally, a person convicted of an offense involving a minor, it could be child pornography, which is a non-contact, non-violent offense. In most European countries anyway, and I don't know about other continents, but in Europe, that's not illegal, right? Seeing pictures of teenagers having sex with each other is not illegal, is my understanding. So they can't understand why our country would be notifying them that this person is coming. And with the language that I told you about, I mean, a lot of people are interpreting that language according to their own standards. So, I mean, if you go to some countries, I understand the age of consent is 12, right? And so they read this and they think, oh, well, your victim must have been 10 or 8 or 7. You know, I mean, they're interpreting this language by their own standards, and the U.S. doesn't do anything to clarify, right? And again, the other thing about, when were you convicted? And, you know, I continue to use Frank Lindsay as an example, even though I finally got the man off the registry. I mean, he was on the registry for 44 years. So for 44 years, right, he was a, quote, covered sex offender well before, by the way, the International Megan's Law was passed. And so he could have had a unique identifier added to his passport. He made the decision after the International Megan's Law was passed not to get a passport. He let his passport expire, and he did not get a new passport because he did not want to have a passport with this unique identifier on it. So, Jeff, would you like to add to this?
I think that's a very thorough articulation. I kind of think of the their laws versus our laws in the context of women in Iran. It turns out it's a crime to be a woman in Iran, not wear a hijab. If you come to California, there is no similar prohibition, and you don't have to wear a particular headgear. Think of it in that way. You're basically going to somewhere as primitive as Iran is on that line of demarcation, and you just have to recognize that if you're in their country, they set the terms, and you have to comply with
them. That's a good analogy. Thank you, Jeff. And folks, again, we're not trying to discourage you from traveling overseas. And by the way, somebody asked a question about, can you, the way I'm interpreting the question or the comment was, can you travel while you're on parole or probation? And that all depends on your conditions, right? And so you can go to your parole officer, you can go to your probation officer and request permission to travel. I know one gentleman who was allowed, for example, he was able to go to Israel, certainly before, when it was safe to go to Israel, let's put it that way. And because of a family member, I can't remember, you know, a family member who was ill. And so he was able basically to go to Israel and basically, you know, say goodbye to his relative. So he was dying. So it can be done, but it's they're pretty stingy many times with parole and probation, are stingy with travel requests. And a lot of times too, that they don't give you a quick answer. And sometimes your travel opportunity has in fact disappeared by then. So sorry about that. Oh my goodness. MK, I have no idea the answer to your question. So sorry about that. Okay. So again, we're here to give you hope. We're here to keep you safe, keep you out of custody, and get you as it limits you to as few registries as possible. And both Jeff and I do help people get off the registry in California using the tiered registry law. So let's move on to Halloween sign requirements. It's a new effort and new area of focus for the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. We were successful in getting rid of all the Halloween sign requirements here in the state of California. And then we moved on to the state of Missouri, where we have a case that's ongoing. We filed a second case outside the state of California in Arkansas. It's already been filed, and I'm going to give some details about both of those cases. And we're now moving to Texas. So there's a town in southern Texas. I believe it's in the Rio Grande Valley. It's called Mission, Texas. We're looking for a possible plaintiff, folks. If you know anybody who's on the registry living in Mission, Texas, and who would not like to put a Halloween sign on their a sign on their front door on Halloween, please have them contact us. Now, there's several towns down in around Mission, according to the news articles that I've read. One of them is Brownsville, which I understand is a larger city as compared to Mission, and it's been in the news from time to time, Brownsville. It's right across the border from Mexico. But anyway, we're looking for a plaintiff in that geographic area. So what the two lawsuits have in common, and this third possible lawsuit, is a requirement by government for persons who are required to register to post a sign on the front door on Halloween. And some people like to say, oh, what's the big deal, right? You put the sign on your door one day of the year. Well, the big deal is your neighbors remember beyond Halloween that you're on the registry, right? And you might live in wherever you live, your neighbors might not actually know that you're on the registry. And I hope that your neighbors do not know, or if they do know, I hope they don't care. I really do. I mean, that's a situation I was in so many years ago before I knew that Frank Lindsay was on the registry. He was my plumber. He came into my home. He did plumbing in my home. I had no idea he was on the registry because guess what? I didn't go check the Megan's Law website. It didn't make a difference to me. So, but there are other people out there, I understand, who have a different opinion. So some of those people, unfortunately, are people who might make your life uncomfortable and possibly even physically harm you if they were to find out that you're on the registry. So that's one reason these Halloween signs are so dangerous. Now, the Halloween sign requirement in the state of Missouri is only for one day, okay, the day of Halloween. The sign requirement in Arkansas is for 2 weeks. So the week before Halloween and the week after Halloween, you're supposed to put a sign on the front door of your home. And there's a big difference, too, about what sign. So in Missouri, you are the one that creates a sign that basically says, you know, I'm on the sex offender registry. In Arkansas, the government is producing this sign. And for the plaintiff in our case, his registration officer showed up at his house with the sign, this pre-printed sign, and put it on his front door. Okay. So there's a vast difference between the two states and what they're doing. And in both cases, we believe that they're violating the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So let me repeat myself. I've said it once and it bears repeating. The U.S. Constitution applies to you even if you're on the registry. There are some people out there who would argue otherwise. They are wrong, okay? Jeff and I are right. The Constitution applies to you even though you're required to register. So therefore, the government cannot compel you to speak. And a lot of times in First Amendment, people think about the right to speak and they don't need to think so much about the requirement to speak and to say something specific. So these Halloween signs, and there's cases already that we use as legal precedent, that in fact, this is compelled speech, the Halloween sign. So in the Missouri case, we're going to trial. We've taken some depositions in the last 30 days, and we should not be going to trial. The facts are the facts in this case. There's no contentions about the case. There's no disagreement about the facts of the case. And yet the Attorney General of Missouri refuses to proceed either through motions for summary judgment or basically just on the papers without oral argument. So I tried. I truly tried to negotiate that we would not be going to trial. It's a waste of the judge's time. It's a waste of judicial resources, on and on. But finally, the attorney attorney general said, look, you are challenging a state law, and I am obligated by law to basically defend a state law, regardless of whether or not they agree with it. Okay. So that's where we are. The trial is going to be on June 20th and June 21st in St. Louis, Missouri. If you want to go to St. Louis and you want to go to an interesting trial, come join us. I don't know if it's going to be available to view it remotely or not, but we'll try to find that out. So anyway, it's going to be 2 days. I'm grateful it's only going to be 2 days because this attorney general, he wants to bring like 10 different witnesses that I'm sure are all going to say the same thing. And one of the things that they're going to say, and they think is the important thing to say, is that the plaintiff in the case is on the registry. Yeah, we know that. They're going to say this registrant has in fact been convicted 5 times of driving while intoxicated. They call them DWIs. In California, it's a DUI, under the influence. And he's punched a few people in the face and been convicted of it. Okay. It's true. He's done all those things. However, remember, he still has constitutional rights and he should not have to put the sign on the front door of his home. So the judge in the case, federal judge, has been agreeing with us all along so far. And the attorney general is not doing himself any favors by including in legal briefs, and I'm not making this up, this is true, the attorney general is saying in legal briefs that the state of Missouri is a sovereign and basically doesn't have to follow federal law. So you can imagine how well that goes over with a federal judge. Yeah, thank you for shaking your head there, Scott. It makes me crazy. And so I'm like, okay, keep saying those things, folks. You want to say those things? And guess what? The federal judge is going to think whatever the federal judge is going to think of you. So far, again, this federal judge granted a temporary restraining order. They're very stingy when it comes to TROs, and yet we got a TRO. Initially, this is last October, and guess what? That TRO is still in place. And one of the things that the AG is saying now, believe it or not, is, oh my gosh, what, we don't know. We need a decision right away, judge. They wanted the trial was supposed to be in March, and then we got it extended because of what the AG did. But anyway, they're saying, we don't know how to plan for Halloween. And we do. We know how they should plan for Halloween. They should just plan not to enforce the Halloween sign requirement. And by the way, there are other Halloween requirements in their state law that are not being challenged. So if they really think people on the registry pose a danger, maybe they should feel some comfort in the fact that the registrants still can't turn on the front porch light. They still can't decorate their house outside the home and these other things. And folks, I think that that's wrong. I think registrants should be able to fully celebrate Halloween, but we don't have a constitutional basis to challenge those other requirements. So that's why we're focused on sign requirements. Jeff, anything you'd like to add there, sir?
I think I'm going to dress up as a judge and I'll give you a good decision. No, I think that's very thorough. I think it's a real creative effort to broaden the constitutional applicability to all of our constituents. And I think the courts will see it as based on prior precedent being compelled that they have to grant it.
So, I mean, I'm an optimist by nature, but I'll tell you, I'm particularly optimistic about the outcome of this case. And by the way, once we win the case, guess what happens? The attorney general has to pay the organization, not me, the organization attorney's fees and costs, including the trips I'm having to make to St. Louis. So, okay, so let's talk about Arkansas. Arkansas was filed after the Missouri case, so it's not as far along in the process. Having said that, we do have a case management conference in the case on May 2nd. And a case management conference, or, we lawyers call them CMCs. The CMC is kind of like a scheduling matter, right? So we're going to talk about, well, if we were to go to trial, when would the trial happen? How many witnesses, whether or not there'd be experts and things like that. So so it's kind of not such a big deal, but it's an important step, going forward. I know I mentioned the Arkansas signs are different as far as what they look like, that they're actually provided by the government and other things. The other way this is different is we're actually not suing the entire state of Arkansas. We're suing one county in the state of Arkansas. And I think because of that, the posture may be different. Okay. So what is a county council going to do as compared to what is the attorney general of the state going to do? We shall see. But so far, the county has not been nearly as active, shall we say, or as big a pain in the neck, as I might say to my children, as the state of Missouri. So we'll see what happens here. And we know that there's multiple counties within Arkansas that are doing this with the Halloween sign requirement. We actually have photographs of the signs that the government has prepared. in some of these other counties and stuff. So, and we only have a plaintiff in the one county, which is Marion County in Arkansas. It's, so we'll see. You know, hopefully if we sue one county and we'll win in that county, then the other counties will go, oops, maybe we shouldn't be doing that after all the sign requirements. So we shall see. Otherwise, we're going to probably be pretty active in Arkansas. And then as far as Texas is going, the city of Mission, Texas, just passed the Halloween sign requirement. That's how it got on my radar screen. I did not know there were any Halloween sign requirements down there. But like happens in many, many jurisdictions, right? One city will adopt a regulation or ordinance, and they go, oh, and the cities next to them go, oh, look at what that city just did. We need to do that too. Okay, so they're copycats. So the city of Mission, Texas, saw that Brownsville and a couple of other cities around them were adding these Halloween sign requirements and said, yeah, we need to do that too. Well, as far as I'm concerned, Mission is target number one. but I'm willing to sue Brownsville or one of the other cities, depending on where we can find a plaintiff. So I'm serious. If you know somebody who lives down in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, and who's on the registry, please let us know. Okay. So that's good enough news as far as the case is going. Again, I'm very optimistic about this, the outcome of the Missouri case. Arkansas is not as far along, and we haven't even filed Texas yet. But let's talk about something else. And this is a big deal in California because it affects over 7,000 people, okay? So we have over 7,000 people in California who are both required to register and who are on parole. Well, there's a state law that tells the Department of Corrections what to do about this. And guess what? The Department of Corrections ignored the state law. It's not the first time, by the way. It's probably not going to be the last time that CDCR has ignored state law. But every time we catch them at it and it affects somebody in the registrant community, we sue them. And so far, we have a 100% success rate in suing the California Department of Corrections. So not being boastful, I'm just stating facts. So here we go. We file another lawsuit about the treatment. And we're talking about counseling. We're talking about polygraph exams. We're talking about the containment model, all of those things, right? And that CDCR, we caught them in a case. I found this case, and at the beginning, I'm like, oh, man, we're not going to go anywhere in this case, because I thought it was going to be so difficult to catch CDCR, to get them to admit that they were breaking the law. But you know what? Turned out wasn't difficult at all. So in a case involved in Santa Clara, a county here in California, CDCR, two of their witnesses blurted out, just testified, oh, yeah, we have a policy. Our policy is that everybody on the registry, the entire time they're on parole, is required to undergo treatment. And guess what? That's not what the law says. So we caught CDCR, and there's a term for this called underground policy. So we caught CDCR with an underground policy. And guess what? The law says that if CDCR broke this law, that a Superior Court judge could terminate treatment for an individual at any time. And that, in fact, is exactly what that judge did. So it's like a guillotine coming down. I have to tell you, it was very rewarding to watch. So she found, the judge said, wait a minute, to the CDCR witnesses, you just testified, and this is the judge. She goes, wait a minute, did I just hear you correctly? Did you just testify that you have this policy? And they're like, oh yeah, that's our policy. And that was it. I mean, she didn't completely lose it, but she was pretty upset with CDCR, and she just said, that's it, no more treatment for this individual. Somebody, by the way, who'd been in treatment for, I think, 5 years, he was doing beautifully in treatment, he had a very stable life, he had joined a union, and he went from apprentice to journeyman, and as a journeyman, he was being given more, he's getting paid better, number one, but also being given more responsibility at work, and so this counseling requirements and stuff are really interfering with his ability to work and continue to be promoted. Okay, so Thomas Knight, contact me. The gentleman that I was describing, had a very similar situation. So let me just read Thomas's comment here into the record, because he said to everyone, not just to me privately. He says, I'm in Santa Clara County, and I've been on parole for 2.5 years, and have been in treatment the entire time with 3 different providers, and have had to start over each time they change providers. That is exactly the fact pattern the gentleman that I represented in Santa Clara County was successful with. So let me tell you, so I think that I can help you, but let me tell you that there's help on the way for everybody, not just in Santa Clara County. So when we filed this lawsuit challenging CDCR's policy and saying that a quote was inconsistent with state law, it's basically telling CDCR they broke the law. To our shock, not just surprise, but shock, attorneys, government attorneys contacted us and said, you know what? You're right. Our client broke the law. I want to tell you, I almost fell out of my chair. These attorneys were saying their client, the Department of Corrections, had broken the law. And then the next part was, how do we fix it? So we are in some very serious settlement negotiations with those four government attorneys on how to fix a problem. So I can't share with you the written agreement. There's a written settlement agreement. The attorneys have agreed on the language, and that happened on April 9th. We have a meeting next week on April 23rd, where we're coming back and sharing what our clients have to say about the settlement agreement. So the attorneys can't just come up with this brilliant settlement agreement, which of course we think we did. We have to go back to our clients and say, would you be willing to accept the terms of the settlement agreement? And I want to tell, there's a hand up. I'll be right with you, JB. Let me just describe the settlement agreement. In order to be consistent with state law, the Department of Corrections is going to basically have a formal meeting with the treatment provider after the first year of treatment. And together, the CDC, the parole officer, and the treatment provider are going to make a decision about whether or not additional treatment's required. That's not happening now, okay? And then they're going to put their decision in writing. That's not happening now. And then on top of that, they're going to have to give a copy of the written decision. They're going to have to give a copy of the written decision to the parolee, okay? The reason that is so important, okay, in the treatment world is then if the decision is the wrong decision, you can take CDCR to court under a writ of habeas writ, okay? And I mean, it's just huge. And by the way, they're not just going to do it once, CDCR, they're going to do it every single year. So every single year on your quote anniversary, CDCR is going to have to talk to the treatment provider, and they're going to have to make a decision about whether or not further treatment's required. And we're talking about everything here. We're talking about counseling, group counseling, individual counseling, polygraphs, and all that other stuff. And so, yeah. And one reason this is so important is that people are being denied early discharge from parole because they're still required to undergo treatment. I don't know if you all are aware of that or not, but very few people who are required to register are getting early discharge under, which is possible, but it's discretionary. They're not getting early discharge for the sole reason that they're undergoing treatment. And they're undergoing treatment because CDCR is requiring them to undergo treatment. It's like, you know, the dog chasing his tail round and round. So this settlement agreement is, you know, close to finality, but it's not final yet. And by the way, one of the mechanism is to the CDCR will issue regulation. Okay, so it's basically they're going to issue regulations with these things that I've outlined and more. And in the regulations, they're going to issue these as emergency regulations. That we said that was it's non-negotiable. It has to be done as an emergency regulation because, pardon me, if it is done as an emergency regulation, then what happens? It will be done in 6 months' time. If it's not an emergency regulation, it could take up to 2 years or maybe even longer. So it's really important. It's a deal breaker to us that it has to remain an emergency regulation and we're not going to agree to it. So JB, I do see that your hand is up. Why don't you go ahead and ask your question? Whoops.
Okay. My question pertains to specifically, I'm on parole, right? I'm off parole, but my experiences with these treatment agencies, which are profit organizations, yeah, which will be losing customers as a result, yeah, of it, is that it's going to be so subjective based rather than objective based. And obviously with parole having a care factor question. So do you have any influence on that, or is that something that's just going to have to work through the system before?
Well, I think that we have influence in it because of the requirement that they put it in writing, you know, not just yes or no decision, but why, the rationale, right? And they have to give it to the parolee. And so if the parolee is not happy with that decision, guess what? All you have to do is go to a lawyer. And then we have a piece of paper to take for the judge to review. So let's give an absurd example. Like if you're on parole and you're not supposed to drink and, you know, you've been tested three times for alcohol and all three times it says you drink alcohol. Well, folks, I'm sorry. I don't agree with that parole condition, but if you have it, you need to comply with it, right? And so somebody like that, they say, yeah, you further treatment's required because you basically have violated the same parole condition three times, right? Well, you know, I don't think judges will be sympathetic to that. But on the other hand, if you have had no violations, right, you haven't violated any parole condition, well, then why, or, you know, done anything else like rob a bank, murder somebody, you know, then why in the world would you have to continue? And, you know, one of the things that was really important in what the person said was this whole thing about treatment providers being changing out, right? So again, with the gentleman in Santa Clara County, that was part of his experience. So he'd have like one company would be, you know, in charge and have treatment providers. And then 2 years later, the next one would come in and they'd make him start the program all over again. Well, that's wrong. It's just wrong. And it's inconsistent with state law. So that's, again, one of the things we're going to try to stop here. And I don't know if they do it deliberately or not, but I do believe profit motive is involved here. On both sides of the fence, by the way, CDCR has a profit motive of sorts, and the companies certainly have a profit motive. So like CDCR, they want as many people on parole as possible, because guess what? That gives them a bigger budget. They're supervising more people. They get more employees. They get a bigger budget. When it comes to the treatment providers, oh my gosh, well, of course, they're making more money from the number of people who are required to undergo counseling. So JD, you've had your hand up. Thank you for being patient. Do you have a question for us?
Yeah, I do. Hi, good morning. When you have this settlement agreement, is it like public? Can I use that in court?
Absolutely. Yes, it will be public.
Yeah, because I filed suit against my parole officer on my own since I couldn't afford a lawyer in Santa Clara County. And for not only that, but also they kept me off discharge because of not completing, but I had completed what's called an RPP, relapse prevention program, and that report basically is with your with Sharper Future. Basically, once you complete that, they basically say you've done the curriculum, you've done this report, now it's just up to parole to let you go. And then
it's not going to happen though, JD. I'm going to interrupt you because it's just not going to happen. Okay, I'm telling you what CDCR testified to under oath in Santa Clara County in the lawsuit. They testified right there under oath in front of the judge that they have a policy that every single registrant the entire time on their parole is required to undergo treatment. And the judge said that said, I don't think so. Okay.
Yeah.
And she said,
well,
for
I'm
that
off
particular
parole
person.
Now.
Well,
I'm
and I'm happy. I'm happy for you. Yeah. But but we need to solve the problem for over 7,000 people. So that's what this lawsuit's all about. It's applied to everybody who's currently on parole. Okay. And, you know, and if CDCR does not act in good faith, we will take them back to court. In fact, one of the provisions of the settlement agreement is we are not going to dismiss let me put in the positive. We will dismiss the case, but without prejudice, which means that we can go right back into the same court and the same judge and say, guess what? CDCR is acting in bad faith here. And then this judge can do what judges do. Okay.
Is the case number somewhere to be found?
Of course, in my files. And I can't go find it right now. But wait a minute. Go to the Axol website. We've written articles about this case. Again, just look for CDCR treatment, like as a search term. You should find the article. We have copies of the complaint there. We do. And the case number. And if not, send me an email and I'll give it to you personally.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah. And so JB is concurring here. It says this impacts people on treatment. Some have 10 years. I know that I have 20 years. You're right. I mean, this is just, it's crazy. What? I mean, the parole periods and stuff. So we are talking about 7,000 people, right? And I'm sure that number is growing because people have longer and longer parole terms. And by the way, one of the frustrating parts about this is when, you know, some of the organizations like ACLU or Root and Rebound or, you know, the others, they want to go into the legislature and get relief for people on parole. Guess what happens? Without exception, the law gets passed and it says, oh, unless you were convicted of a sex. And folks, that doesn't make any sense. It does not make any sense. But that's what's been happening. So we get thrown under the bus, and legislatively speaking. Okay. So I'm very happy about that. And again, April 23rd, just next week, hopefully we will have gotten green lights from all of our clients. hopefully we can talk about the settlement agreement. Maybe we can even post it on our website. Right now, there's no provision in there that says it's confidential. I'm just telling you, but that is something that they might insist upon. And if I get everything I want, and they said that the agreement has to be confidential, I have to agree. I will say that I'll probably agree to that because I'll make sure that I can describe it, you know, without providing the actual agreement itself. Okay, so that's really good news for registrants who are on parole in California. All right, so let's talk about the tiered registry law itself. More good news here, folks, and I'm absolutely serious about it. Jeff, I know you're happy about it too. We have three published appellate decisions that say the same thing, and we have at least two unpublished appellate decisions that say the same thing. And a common thread here in these cases is that the DA has a burden to prove that you pose a current risk to society or public safety. And if they cannot prove it, then the judge must grant your petition. Okay. So we're talking about the tiered registry law. We're talking about the petitioning process. And in the petitioning process, a really important, possibly the most important consideration is whether or not the district attorney is going to object to your petition. And in the past, if the DA objected to your petition, that meant there was going to be a hearing. And then guess what? The DA thought that we had to prove that the registrant did not pose a current risk, but now the tables have turned and now the courts have said, oh, no, no. Instead, what has to happen is the DA must prove that this person poses a current risk. So, Jeff, I hope you can expand upon that. We'll take a quick break.
Sure. So if you go to the time period before the new law was adopted in 2017, the way people terminated was through being eligible and filing certificate of rehabilitation. That had as its design that the obligation was on the petitioner to prove that they were entitled to be relieved. It was a very vague standard of what that was, a lot of discretion to the judge, and the judges tended to deny those petitions more often than not. When the new law was designed, it changed the standard that's specifically stated in the law to this. In order to retain someone, the evidence has to prove that the retention on the registry significantly enhances public safety. What the DAs began doing when these cases were filed seeking termination is that the DAs would bring out the original conviction offense that required registration, and they'd articulate all the facts, and they'd basically say, kind of, the sky is falling, this is such an awful thing, you should keep this person on the registry. The first case that came along, and the ones that all the other cases have followed, is a case published, the name of the case is People versus Thai, like a Thai restaurant. And in that case, the DA did that showing of the terrible, awful, horrible nature of the original offense. And the appellate department, the trial department, upheld the denial that the DA had asked for, but the reversal that the appellate court ordered said, no, this person's entitled to termination. They're ordering termination. And that's because the DA did not offer proof that continued registration would significantly enhance community safety. That's the legal standard that the legislature adopted. And failing that proof, entitlement to termination exists. So going forward, all the cases have followed that line of reasoning. So your issue is not what was the nature of your original offense. There's a number of criteria listed in the law, but all of them loop back to what is the determination or the basis for determining that continued registration will significantly enhance community safety. And for that reason, DAs are much less willing to resist these petitions, and bringing the petitions produces no risk whatsoever to the person seeking termination and great potential gain. So for that reason, I think a lot of folks are reluctant to bring these petitions, being fearful of the uncertainty of it. And what I would say the takeaway should be is that if you are eligible based on time since your release, you should file a petition and make that effort. There are different ways that petitions can be filed. The two basic strategies are to file a bare bones minimalist petition. It's a fairly straightforward check the box, fill in the blanks, serve the papers kind of petition. information, and then it goes to law enforcement. Law enforcement has 60 days to determine only the question of whether you're eligible under the law, not entitled to it on that significant risk, but eligible from a time passing. The second thing that happens is they report that to the DA, and the DA then has 60 days to form a position about whether they're going to agree to the termination or whether they're going to oppose it. The two ways to approach that are to offer nothing and let them just look at the bare record, or to put together background individualized to express a basis for the DA being convinced that you wouldn't add to the community risk if you're off registration. I've taken that approach on most of the cases that I've filed, and it's been successful in places where we thought it might be marginal otherwise. If the DA agrees that they're not going to oppose termination, the judge must sign the termination order. Once the court signs the termination order, the next piece that you have to cope with deals with how local law enforcement that is doing your registration responds to the court order. And thus far, most agencies have said they want to get DOJ's confirmation that you're terminated, not just the court order. So for those reasons, I've taken, and I know Janice has taken, the approach of directly sending the termination order to DOJ, and that has greatly expedited DOJ taking the next step, which is to prepare a letter to you. A copy goes to the agency that says you're terminated, you no longer have a duty to register, and then you're done in California. You're muted, Janice.
Thank you, Jeff. You gave a very comprehensive report there about the tiered registry law. So I see that Jay has his hand up. Jay, would you like to mute yourself? Do you have a question or comment? Jay, you're unmuted now, and your hand is up.
Maybe not.
Okay, we're moving on to GSH. Would you please unmute yourself?
Thank you, Janice. I just want to say thankful to those of you who worked so hard to get this law through, that we've all been told what terrible people we are for so long, and finally to walk in where they have to prove it and not just say so, felt like a miracle to me. So thank you so much for all of you that worked so very hard to get the legislature to make this decision.
Well, you're very welcome. Yeah. And folks, I guess I can't overemphasize the fact that when the DA has a burden to prove something, it's a huge, huge deal. You know, because it's really hard to prove a negative. How do you prove? I mean, you know, and Jeff and I have had a lot of success using psychologists and psychological evaluations to basically opine that is less likely, or, you know, it's that a person poses a low or even very low risk of reoffense. That helps a judge. It does. But the tables have turned here now. And part of this is, and oh my goodness, there's a molecule or two of my body that feels sorry for the DA, but only a molecule or two, because it's really hard. It's really hard for them to prove that you pose a current risk, because they can, if you have a clean record, by the way, a clean criminal record, because they cannot order you to undergo a psychological evaluation. So Jeff and I used to, well, I don't know about your practice, Jeff, but now since the Thai case and the others, I don't make a recommendation to my client that there be a psychological evaluation done. Because why? It's not our burden. We don't have to prove that anymore. It's really up to the DA's office. And I had a case, and this was actually even before the Thai case, and it was in Los Angeles County, a woman who was on the registry for more than 30 years, and the judge, well, the judge at the DA's request ordered a psychological evaluation of my client. And fortunately, when it got, that order got to probation, the probation department said, no, she's not on probation. Right. Thank goodness they said that. And the other thing is, it's different for a female registrant, by the way. There is no such, the static 99 does not apply to a female registrant. It's not a valid instrument. So anyway, the right thing was done in that case. But again, for the DAs right now, because they have the burden of proof that you pose a current danger, one way they might be able to do that is through a psychological evaluation. And folks, if you ever get in a situation, do not agree referee to a psychological evaluation by a psychologist chosen by CDCR, because you know what the outcomes could be, or by the DA, either one. So Jay, you've got your back and your hands up. Again, do you want to have a question or comment? Because later, earlier when we called on you, we couldn't hear you. And now we can't hear you again. All right, Jay. Oh, are you there?
So, sorry about that. I had a tech issue going on there. Okay. So thanks for your patience there. So firstly, thanks to you and Jeff for all you guys do. I just received my DOJ letter that Jeff was talking about. Right. And it's something I hope everyone gets. And when we get the registry abolished, and I read your article about it's a game of Jenga. It's very well written, and I hope everyone gets a chance to read that. But I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that the original SB 84 was the law that's not something you originally asked for. I'm wondering what the original one that you proposed entailed and how it differs from SB 84, and if there's something that maybe Axaw is putting together besides the off-ramp for Tier 3s that might be in the works for next year's session of the legislature.
Yes, thank you for asking those questions, Jay. So the original tiered registry bill, which was not even Senate Bill 384, it was predecessor bill, was going to be based upon risk level of risk, okay? And we anticipated that original bill and not the conviction offense, okay? So current risk, not conviction offense. And our estimate was that 90% of the people on the registry would be eligible to petition for removal. And or they were automatically going to get off the registry. So people like, I always pick on Frank, here we go. So people like Frank, who have had already registered for 30 years, they were automatically going to be removed from the registry. Okay. This was the original bill, not the ultimate bill. So people on the registry for more than 30 years, automatically off. It was going to be based upon current risk and not based upon conviction offense. And there were a lot fewer offenses that were assigned to Tier 3. So during the legislative process, and it's not unique to this subject, but to the legislative process, there's always political compromises that are made. And so the story, this is a true story, in the year 2017, on the Friday before Labor Day, the chair of the Appropriations Committee in the Assembly here in California killed the bill. I mean, it was dead. It was a very sad day. We, at that point in time, like, we had worked for 6.5 years to get this bill, right? And so it was devastating. And I decided to deal with it by basically opening a bottle of wine, baking brownies, and binging on Netflix. So, and I, it was Labor Day weekend, right? And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a terrible weekend. But what I didn't know was that the governor, Jerry Brown, the governor then, called up the chair who killed the bill. Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher is her name. She's from San Diego, and no longer a member of the Assembly, but she was the chair of Appropriations Committee at the time, and called Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher and said, nope, that's a wrong answer. You're going to revive this bill. To this day, I do not know why Governor Brown did that. I'm grateful that he did it. I don't know why, and I guess in part, I don't care why, but the fact is the bill was revived. However, Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher, who was the chair of the Appropriations Committee and who had the power to do this, said, okay, Governor, I'll revive the bill, but, you know, I'm going to make a few changes to it, okay? And some of the changes she made were huge and enormous, like putting everybody convicted of felony possession of child pornography up on the highest tier of Tier 3. Makes no sense. It's a no contact, nonviolent offense, and you put them on Tier 3, makes no sense. But at the point in time, she was receiving had received a lot of money from the law enforcement community, and that's what they wanted. So that's what she did, okay? And so overall, the biggest picture is this. We went from 90% of the registrants being eligible to petition to 45% of the registrants being eligible. So it basically got cut in half, okay? We believe that is unacceptable. And ever since that happened, and really, political compromises are just that. So Senator Wiener, who was the author of the bill, he did not consult with us to ask us, would you rather have half of a loaf of bread or no bread at all? He didn't. Having said that, I probably would have said, yeah, half a loaf is better than nothing. So we at least have something that we're working with. I know I'm almost at 100 of my clients that I've gotten off the registry so far, and I celebrate each and every person who I've helped get off the registry. It's such a fabulous feeling. You know, it's like, oh, it's like the best day of my life again, you know, almost 100 times now. And for the person too, I'm hoping and praying that it's also good for you. So So what we're doing as an organization is we're going back, we have gone back to the Sex Offender Management Board. It's been now, 16 months ago that we went to the board and said, look, here are 7 changes we think need to be made immediately to the tiered registry law. And so, you know, they're a governmental board. They take a long time. They move slowly. I feel like I'm watching a snail, you know, it's a race of snails here. But anyway, finally, in the end of last year, so 2023, they said that they agreed with us on some of our requests, and some of them were just too far to go for them. And then they surprised us by adding some of their own. So right now, these are the things that the Sex Offender Management Board is recommending these changes. Number one, to create to reduce from tier 3 to tier 2, people convicted of Penal Code Section 288C. This is lewd or lascivious acts with somebody who's 14 or 15 years old. Right now, they're on the highest tier. Whereas somebody with the same conduct with a younger victim is on tier 2. So they've agreed with us that that needs to be done. Number one, reduce from tier 3 to tier 1 people convicted of felony possession of child pornography. Huge. That's going to affect a lot more people than the 288C issue. But still, both of those are important. And then three, for them, this is on their own initiative. People convicted of 288.2, 288.3, and 288.4, all of those people, they would have their tiers reduced from tier 3 to tier 2. Okay, so these are important changes. We don't think it goes far enough, but they're important changes. We lobbied for these things last month in March here in Sacramento. We will be lobbying for them again next year. And I think that next year that we have a decent chance of getting them through the legislature. So I'm hoping that we can convince the Sex Offender Management Board to add a couple more to these, right? But we shall see. And I do believe in incrementalism, whether it's through legislation or it's through litigation, we have to keep taking these small steps. And as I said, you know, in the column about the Jenga game, it's just we're pulling out piece by piece, and we're just waiting for the whole darn registry to collapse, right? And I cannot wait for that day. That day, I don't know how we're going to celebrate, but we're going to have one heck of a celebration. We may just have to have a Zoom with, we'll all have our own bottles of champagne or something, I don't know, or sparkling apple juice. But whatever it is, folks, we're working really hard every single day. And it's gratifying to see change. On the other hand, sometimes it can be frustrating as heck, right? Waiting for these snails to get across the finish line. Jeff, what would you like to add to that?
You know, I think that's basically a great summary, and I don't think there's anything needed to be added. It's it is one of the realities. I was on a conference call last night with legislative people in another organization that I'm longtime involvement with. It's a tough year in the legislature for criminal defense issues.
And, this year.
Yeah. And we're you know, it's an election year, so we're being cautious about proceeding and have made the strategic decision to proceed in 2025, because the basic measure is, how are the political people going to fear or embrace the proposed legislation, and what alliances can we reach to make this a viable or a more likely to be successful proposal? Those are things that are unfolding. This is a good decision, clearly, from all the feedback that this year is not a good year due to the national election. And I think, you know, we have work to do to collect allies and to try and develop a firm strategy about how we're going to persuade reluctant members of the legislature to see this as something that they can take a risk on. And that's the challenge we're trying to manage.
And Jeff has just given a really good snapshot of the political reality, right? So this is a presidential election year. The state legislators individually are not known to be brave. Some of them are, but I'd say most of them are not. And I think in presidential election years, they turn into jellyfish, which means they don't have a backbone at all. So trying to get something, you know, I think we just get slimed. We tried, you know, earlier this year. We did have lobby day and stuff, but we knew knew what we were doing. And this is, I use a gardening analogy because I'm a gardener too, you know, as a hobby. So the fact is that we were tilling the soil. We were fertilizing the seed, you know, planting seeds and fertilizing. That's what we were doing this year. So that next year in 2025, we can go forward with, okay, watch, hopefully we'll have a lot of stuff up there, if not some ripe tomatoes, right? And we need a sponsor for the bill. We need an author for the bill. We need to, you know, and getting the bill written is nothing. It really is a kind of a minor detail, believe it or not, but we need to get these changes made to the tiered registry law. And as Jeff said, it's also important to get together with other groups. So he didn't mention any group in particular, but I know that Jeff has worked in the past with the California Attorneys for Criminal Justice. They have a much larger presence in the state capitol than we do. They have a lot more resources than we do. And CACJ has in fact supported these proposed changes to the tiered registered law and other changes as well, including tier three, getting people who are assigned to tier three, creating an off ramp for them so that at least after 30 years that they would in fact be able to petition for removal. And folks, that's really important too. I mean, the legislators did this on purpose, right? They didn't want to have to make a decision person by person whether or not you got off the registry. So they said, oh, we know what we'll do. We'll leave it to the judges, right? Because remember, do I need to call them a jellyfish again? Anyway, the jellyfishes, you know, they don't want to make difficult decisions. So they just basically, they delegated it to the courts. So Craig, you've got your hand up. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I kind of wanted to circle around similar on the tier assignments. You know, you're talking about the different tier assignments, and then you also recently published that article where the Department of Justice was agreeing to reduce some of those tier assignments for like attempted offenses. Yes. Are you able to speak to some of that or what that entails, or do you have enough detail on that yet?
Oh, yeah, I love talking about that. That one's final. We have a court decision on that one, so yeah. Right before I go there, somebody asked in the chat room about 311.11a, so the possession of child pornography. Yes, what the Sex Offender Management Board's proposing, what we've been lobbying for since 2017, since this bill passed, is that CP offenses be reduced to tier one. And this is a weird situation in that the federal government actually agrees with us. So if we were a SORNA state, it would be tier one. So anyway, I rarely point out the federal government as a good example, but this is the one of the exceptions. And so as far as the attempted offenses, we filed a lawsuit. We basically sued the California Department of Justice. And our basis was we believed that DOJ was incorrectly interpreting tiered registry law by putting people who are convicted of an attempted offense on the same tier as those who were convicted of a completed offense. And so for me, as I've always used rape as an example, because it just seems to me the easiest one, and I call it the zipper defense or whatever offense. So somebody unzips a zipper, the other end says, oh, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And the other person says, no, thank you. And the person walks away. Now, so that could be interpreted as an attempted rape. Okay. And Jeff is a criminal defense attorney, not me. But the fact is, I think that it could, in certain circumstances, be considered an attempted rape. So what has been happening is that California DOJ was putting a person convicted of an attempted rape on the same tier as somebody who was in fact convicted of rape. Wrong. Wrong, wrong answer. That was not consistent with our interpretation of tiered registry law. And fortunately, a judge agreed with us and said, no, California DOJ, you've made a mistake here. So now the court is requiring, in its decision, is requiring California DOJ to attempt to tier an attempted offense differently than a completed offense. And it must be a lower tier. Okay, so some people are going from tier three to tier one. Actually, a lot of people will go from tier three to tier one. I've already helped some people, a couple of people do that. The process for doing it is not clear. We've already sent a letter to California DOJ asking, what's the process for doing this? So we came up with our own process, which I hope is just temporary. But what I'm talking about is writing a letter to California Department of Justice about an individual and specifically requesting that this person's tier be reassigned from tier three to tier one. Okay, folks, I want you to hear this. This is really important. This is only for people convicted of an attempt. And that penal code section is 664. Usually when I see it, it's a 664 slash like maybe a 288 or something like that. Okay. But it's not the same as assault with intent to do something. That's not the same. Okay. We're only talking about people who've been convicted of an attempted offense. One way, if you're unclear yourself about whether or not you're convicted of an attempt, is to get something called a live scan report. Okay. And if you want to know how to do that, send me an email. I'll send you the application and tell you the steps to take. You'll get the report back in a week or two, okay, through the mail. Not through me, but from the Department of Justice, believe it or not. So anyway, it's an important victory that we won in court. I think it's going to help hundreds of people. When we're talking earlier about the CDCR treatment lawsuit, I know that it will help 1,000 people. But each one of these is important, right? Each one of these is like pulling out that block in the Jenga tower and what it, in fact, is going to make the tower collapse. So I'm very grateful that we got the ruling that we did in that case.
Janice,
is
that similar to like one quick note about LiveScan?
Please.
So LiveScan reports are the net accumulation of what law enforcement sends to DOJ. DOJ does not make up the records. They just document the records that come from two sources. One is from the court. The other is from police departments or sheriff's departments. I have found endless mistakes on LiveScan reports, and there's a record correction process that you can go through to get the LiveScan to accurately track, but it requires going back to the court or sometimes going back to the law enforcement agencies to get those records corrected, to get certified documents to be able to send to DOJ, and then being patient because DOJ does this at a very slow rate. But it's LiveScans are not obvious. They're very technical in the way that they're put together, and it's very important to appreciate that you have to scrutinize them closely to determine where the errors are and get things fixed so that you don't get misrepresented. I'm going to be in court on the 30th on a client who had a case transferred from County 1 to County 2. County 2 is supposed to just document that he was there. Instead, they listed him as having a new conviction based on the date of the transfer of the case. So now instead of having one, he's got two. These kinds of record screw-ups are because people do it and people are mistaken in the way they do things. So don't think just because it's in a live scan, it's gospel.
And I don't, Jeff. I hear what you're saying.
Everybody else, not you. I know you.
Well, no, for all of us, because, and you're like, well, if the live scan is wrong, then how do you prove it? And the next thing I tell people anyway is we need to go back to the court and get the court documents. Many times a sentencing report, sometimes a court transcript if it's available. There's mistakes made all over. Unfortunately, folks, the government is not careful. Let's just leave it at that. Okay. So I think that's about where I wanted to be, what the topics I wanted to cover today. I think that, there was somebody asked a question about the tiered registry and where do you file a petition? You file the petition in the county where you register. Okay. So not where you were convicted, but in the county where you currently register and reside. And so that's where you file it. A copy will be served upon the DA because it was specific to the DA. A copy will be served upon the DA's office where you were convicted as well. Okay, that has to happen. But in about 99 out of 100 times, the DA's office where you were convicted has nothing to say, and it's crickets. I one terrible exception that I don't need to get into, but most of the time, the county where you were convicted, the DA's, they just don't care. At least that's been my experience. How about you with you, Jeff?
I'm sorry, was that a question for me? Yeah, I've never gotten a comment back from the county of conviction where it's different from the county of current registration.
And I've only had it happen once. So folks, let's just wind up this meeting. I know that in the chat room, people are reminding others that if we've said anything valuable today, if you'd like us to keep fighting for you and your rights, a donation would be very, would be grateful. We'll be very grateful for any donation that you could make. We are completely dependent upon funding from people like you. We've applied for grants in the past and not been successful. The next meeting, just to let you know, if you want to keep this on your dance card, is May 18. We always meet on the third Saturday of the month. So May 18th will be the next meeting. And I'm sorry for the person that has your hand up. We're not going to take your question right now. But if you want to contact me separately, I'll be happy to answer your question. Thank you, everybody. Have a blessed day. Hope to see you next month. Bye-bye.